I'm Jody Kretzman, and I'm here for a few weeks on teaching staff, and this week doing a few sessions under an incredibly obscure title, for which I apologize. I don't usually reach for obscurity, but in this case I did reach for obscurity, and it wasn't entirely accidental that I've got an obscure title, that we're calling this The Forgotten Frontier. As I think we mentioned in my initial session, one of the reasons is that two things by the forgotten frontier, and one of the things that I mean by forgotten frontier is something that very few people at Holden are interested in. I think, however, it's absolutely necessary to be interested in this first thing, and that is American cities. I talked a little bit the first time about the ways in which American cities seem to me to be both forgotten and a frontier. And the fact, in fact, that they are a frontier seems to me to mitigate against their being forgotten. That is, they shouldn't be forgotten. Are we finding ways to do this in a circle? Okay. Great. So one of the confessional things that I have to say at the beginning of these sessions is that one of the quirks and pieces of craziness that one has to deal with when you deal with, I think, both Ingrid, my spouse, and me, is that we love cities. And that seems not to be a sort of 1987 thing to do. It's to be absolutely in love with the chaos and the diversity and the ungovernability and the poverty and the wealth and all of that that make up American cities. We really have grown to like that a lot, all of it. And that is a part of ourselves that, coming from Chicago to Holden, we try to bring with us. I guess there's part of me that thinks about Holden, in fact, as an outpost of urban America. That, in fact, even Holden is an extension of increasingly global urban-centered systems, right? There's not a whole lot, even on potato night, that we eat in the dining room that isn't grown and produced in urban-centered kinds of increasingly large organizations. Well, enough of that. Forgotten Frontier, first of all, is a city, but I want to use the city to open up a second part of the Forgotten Frontier, and that is our capacity as U.S. citizens here, and I suppose I can include some Canadians if we've got them here, but I'm talking particularly the United States citizens, are increasingly, I think, diminishing capacity to engage in discussion of public policy issues. I want to use cities, I'm saying, to reopen up, if possible, some excitement about the public agenda that I think hasn't been there for about the last decade in life in the United States. And I think without excitement about a public agenda, our democracy is in deep, deep trouble. There are lots of reasons, it seems to me, why the realm of public discussion and public issue debate and public policy development is no longer, or at least not at this moment in our history, at the top of the agenda for a lot of people. And we can get into some of those. But I do think that the whole realm of public discussion is a forgotten frontier, in some ways like cities. The subtitle tonight is Hope Comes in Many Colors. And I wanted to contrast that with a session that we did a couple of days ago that had hopelessness in its title, and that concentrated on on looking at the ways in which the unfolding post-industrial American economy is robbing, it seems to me, the United States and perhaps some other parts of the world of some valuable resources. We talked about increasing ways in which poverty affects the United States. We talked about the kind of rootlessness that seems to be attendant to our kind of economy. We talked about the potential, at least, de-skilling of work and labor and the denuding of meaning from the area of work. And we talked about the problem of our own, as public citizens, control over the process of the economy. And it left me, at least, and some others that I chatted with afterwards, in a sort of hopeless state. And perhaps that kind of dealing with the mega problems of the economy and the hopelessness that engenders is one reason why people are so shy about getting into public policy debates these days. You need hope, it seems to me, to be on the public stage. So I want to talk about hope tonight in the context of many colors. And I want to make just a few simple points and then hopefully have some time for some input and discussion for you. I want to share with you what for me is the major source of hope for public life in the United States over the next couple of decades. And I think probably some of you share this position, but I want to explore it because it opens up an awful lot of dilemmas and problems. There's a sense, of course, in which part of the heritage, as we go up to the 4th of July and as we're celebrating the 200th year of the Constitution, part of the heritage of the United States is a real strain of a wish to provide moral and ethical leadership for the rest of the world, right? From the constituting convention on, there was a kind of messianic fervor to the creation of the United States. And part, it seems to me, of trying to raise in constructive ways public policy questions again today is to recapture some of that fervor about what it is a constructive agenda might look like these days. So part of what this is about is seeing in a time when lots of American citizens of lots of different political persuasions are feeling at least detached from feeling good about their country, if not absolutely hostile to some aspects of their nation's face to the rest of the world, and in fact at a time when the rest of the world is, I think, demonstrably feeling more negative toward the image that the United States and the role that the United States plays in the world. What do we have that constitutes a positive and constructive set of moral and ethical possibilities for us? And that's what I want to talk about. What do we have that's sort of beacon to humankind? It seems to me arguable that that beacon to humankind is not any longer the road to economic prosperity. That is, we used to be able to talk about the land of opportunity, but what we mostly meant by that was opportunity for economic advancement. That, I think, again, partly based on our discussion last time, is increasingly problematic to sell. It's increasingly problematic not only in terms of the fact of it, that is that we are no longer the wealthiest nation on earth, but also in terms of the moral and ethical dimensions of our economy. What I want to suggest today is that the major set of possibilities for moral and ethical leadership on a global level for the United States in the next decades involves the working out of a very difficult but very exciting multicultural reality. One which models for the world the diversity and the unity of the peoples of the world. This is a pretty simple thing to say. The title that I gave the session is meant to say that hope comes in many colors. Moral and ethical leadership for the United States in the world, I'm arguing tonight, is dependent upon the taking seriously of the agenda of multicultural nation building. And I want to underscore the hopefulness of that for me, in particular, because of the usual way in which particularly white Americans regard the presence of black and brown and red and yellow Americans in increasing numbers. That is, most whites in the United States, and I catch myself doing it occasionally as well, think about multicultural reality as a problem, as a set of issues at least, as a set of dilemmas, as something that needs solving. I'm saying tonight that it is absolutely a set of opportunities and the major source of hope for moral and ethical leadership on a global stage. Most of the United States, it seems to me, in the 1980s, as segregation has increased, all the statistics tell us that housing segregation and segregation in schools has increased apace over the last decade. Most of white America, it seems to me, has retreated into a stance which basically regards Joseph's coat of many colors, which is our nation, as an invisible reality, an irrelevant reality, one that we wish would go away. I don't know how many of you have had the experience, as we do in Chicago constantly, of hosting visitors from other countries, whether European or Asian or African or Latin American. But almost inevitably, at least if you're in a city and you're hosting visitors from foreign countries, the thing which just blows them away is the colorfulness of the United States. They're absolutely astounded by it. They can't believe that people of that many different hues and that many different cultures can live even in close proximity with each other. Even if they don't get along, it's an amazing fact that they're all there, right? I often take visitors to the high school in my neighborhood, and in that high school, Senn High School in uptown Chicago, 73 separate languages are spoken, to which English is a second language. In one high school, 73 separate languages. And the hue of the people is all the way from very pale to very dark indeed. And 73 national groups are represented within one high school. That kind of reality is not present anyplace else on the globe. It's present in large measure, increasingly large measure, in the United States. And it is for me, I think, a source of intriguing hope. I think on one level this is totally obvious what I'm saying. On the other hand, it seems to me that the minute I start taking serious anyway the notion of a multicultural reality as a resource, as a positive good, as a gift, as a source of hope, I find myself talking a language to most of my white friends which is quite foreign to them. And I also find myself immediately opening up hordes of difficulties. Most of my white acquaintances, I think, and I myself, in many of my worst moments, find multicultural relating to founder on questions like, why can't they be like us? Why can't they adapt to our ways? What is it about them which is lacking? And I am tempted to retreat from the fray. I think most of white America is like that most of the time. I think that we have a lot of fear and a lot of pride and a lot of institutionalized isolation to overcome. But I think that it's important for us to try to understand what our blocks are that stand between us thinking about our multicultural reality as a problem and thinking about it as a source of hope. Did anybody talk with Ted Johnstone while he was here? He talked with the staff a couple of times about, he's a guy who was here with, he's white, his wife Billy is black, he's on the board, and he talked to the staff a little bit about black-white relations a couple of times. And he did an interesting thing that I want to just push for a second a little bit further with the staff that made a big difference. And I think it tells us a little bit about who we are as American citizens and whites these days. He said, he drew on, you know, classic social science kind of categories and said, look, we're three things as individuals, each of us. each of us, I, at one level, am like all other human beings, right? I am a part of humanity. Humanity is my defining group. Part of me is like all other human beings. Part of me is like some other human beings, right? I am a part of a culture. This is the cultural level of our being. And part of me is like no other human being. Right? I am uniquely who I am. You are uniquely who you are. And that every human being in this room and every place else on the earth has all three of those elements. We are all like everybody. We are all like some. And we are all like nobody else. Okay? I wanted to have a blackboard, but both of the 7 o'clock people are so organized that they took the boards away and filled them up early. Now we're going to have to sort of visualize a little bit of this. These are three elements of who we are as human beings. And I'd like to push this simple model a little bit with you for just a second and argue that that for the most part, white United States citizens are at home in only two of those levels. I know that when I'm teaching my students in the city of Chicago, that they are absolutely militantly convinced that they are individuals and that there is nobody else in the entire world like them. And they want me and every other teacher they run into and everybody else on the planet to treat them as the unique individual that they are. Right? They're also fairly certain that they are like everybody else, that they are a part of humanity, and that humanity is the reference point for understanding their connectedness. They don't have a clue, however, about that middle level, about being like some other people and unlike some others. I'm saying most of my white students, and I think really most white Americans, have become acultural, not anti-cultural, but absolutely blind to the fact that there is a middle level of our existence. Right? We are like fish in a sea, and we assume that the sea is all of humanity, not that there are different fish bowls. Right? It seems to me that this point is developed particularly well from a different angle in Robert Bella's book, Habits of the Heart, where he stresses the growth and changing development of the peculiar American kind of individualism, which leads to a detachment from that middle realm, a detachment from any idea of culture. Right? Now, if that's true, and if Americans know about themselves as human beings and as individuals, as members of humankind and as individuals, but not as members of a culture, that makes even thinking about multicultural reality a difficulty. Right? Part of the reason, it seems to me, that Americans are allergic to that middle level of reality is that it implies that there are some limits to our ability to choose. We cannot choose to denude ourselves of that middle level of reality, if in fact the model is right. Right? So that my students are interested in maximizing their individuality, right, and therefore their choices in life, that's what American individualism is all about, and they're not interested in admitting any kind of limits to those choices. Right. Am I a little bit clear about this? Are you okay? So I'm really arguing in relationship to the hope point. I'm arguing that we're caught in a supreme irony here, that in the midst of the most culturally diverse nation on the earth, where our most exportable moral and ethical vision for the rest of the globe is in fact our multicultural identity, we have become mostly a nation of people who don't even know that the notion of culture exists. that's going to be a problem in pursuing the construction of a hopeful future here.
Questions?
Sure.
In that middle level, maybe I'm coming at it from a different perspective, and maybe I'm not quite understanding what you're saying. And yet, America is quite ethnic oriented. I mean, we have our Norwegian groups and our German groups, mm-hmm. and our, you know, Jewish groups, and it, that doesn't fit into this set middle level.
Well, what
or
Bella,
our teenage yeah. group or a punk group, or, you know.
Yeah.
And yet, people identify with these groups and these cultures. That isn't part of what you're saying.
Well, I think it's a good point. What I'm arguing, I think, is that in general, and what Bella argues in the book and others, Richard John Neuhaus, Peter Berger, others that think about this stuff, is that the institutions that have sort of upheld that cultural identity and the diversity in that middle realm, while they're still there, are rapidly dwindling in the power they hold over the individual's way of viewing his or her own life, right? That you just named a set of institutions, mostly, that were from the 19th century or early 20th century, were from the immigrant experience in the United States, and that are disappearing into some kind of a mass consumer culture, where in fact an individual finds identity in a social way, not by belonging to a culturally defined intermediary institution,
society and so on,
but you buy things, right? So punk, for instance, is mostly a consumer phenomenon. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a defining culture in the way that that I think most people use the term, referring to that middle reality.
It's a temporary phenomenon, in a sense.
I think so, and it can be manipulated by the economy.
That probably manipulated was a bad example, but I mean
by
more
the
like
exchange.
The ethnic groups.
Yeah. That's breaking down all over with mobility and with shifts in the economy. Is that?
Mm-hmm,
okay. I do think, though, probably that there are other reasons besides this that people in the United States as a whole back away from the challenge and the hope of building a multicultural set of processes as a model for the world. And I, one major one that occurs to me out of my own experience fairly constantly is that doing multicultural work, and I suspect that lots of you have experience here too, is incredibly difficult. It's frustrating. It's maddening. It's an absolutely enervating and you wonder why in the world you ever got into it occasionally, kind of work to be engaged in, particularly in our kind of setting. But it's not impossible. And I've been thinking then about why it's so difficult. And I'm thinking a lot of this, obviously, because we've been thinking about the Rainbow Weeks coming up here at Holden, but I want to make larger points about it. It seems to me that underlying almost all of the difficulties of black-white interaction or of black-white Hispanic-Indian Asian interaction is always fundamentally the question of power, the question of control, the question of domination, the question of who provides the definitions for the interactions among the groups, right? That's almost always what the problems are about. So one way to think about the challenge of building multicultural processes that work is to think about ways, in fact, in which the dominant culture, white America, denuded of ethnic differentiation, can begin to give up some power, can begin to share some power, can begin to, I mean, the model I think that's working in some sections of political experimentation, and I want to talk about in just a second, and in some sections now of the church, is a model that is simply a table, right, to which groups are invited to engage in the push and pull of democracy. Democracy is nothing more than a process of push and pull, right? And it is a fuller small d democracy when there are more people at the table and when the resources and the skills and the experience that those people bring to the table are more equal. All right. That is exactly the image, let me just bring in the city for a second here, that's exactly the image that more and more actors in the city of Chicago, anyway, are working with. And that image is not the appearance of that image. The table with the players around it and new players around it, not accidentally appeared in Chicago at just at the point of the election of a black mayor. So part of my hope, it seems to me, is that the number of places in the United States where experimenting with getting at the table with a diverse group of people, each having some chips to play in the poker game called democracy, the number of places where that's possible is expanding. Right? And it's expanding precisely because people of color, mostly blacks, but increasingly Latinos as well, are inheriting at least some part of public power in cities. So that's another way in which I think about cities as being the frontier. They are the place where a table is being defined, usually, necessarily, with a black or Hispanic at the head of the table. It's not always just a round table. And the number of players in the game of democracy is being increased. Talking some more about that, it seems to me that there are lots of ways in which blacks, Latinos, and Native Americans at least, not so much Asians, are increasingly locked out of purely economic life in the United States. But they are increasingly important players in political life in the United States. And there are interesting kinds of interactions between those two realms that I think are exciting to work about. Finally, let me just say a few things about the church. And some reason for excitement there too. I think that following this afternoon, this afternoon session with Dave Brown and Paul Monson, no, it must have been this morning, Dave Brown and Paul Monson, Chuck Lutz, talking about the formation of the New Lutheran Church. They talked about that incredible commission on a New Lutheran Church, which was intentionally multiracial, intentionally followed patterns that got different people to the table, and the excitement that that brought. It seems to me that there is a real adoption, at least intellectually, of the model of the table and the actors coming to the table on the part of that new church body. That's reflected in some other mainline churches across the country, it seemed to me, at this point. And that has generated a lot of excitement in the black and Hispanic communities, particularly across the country. Some of you are aware that when that stuff gets going in churches as well as in city governments, lots of different dilemmas arise. Let me just get close to concluding my opening remarks here with just filling you in on a couple. Some of you may be aware that there's a new desk for multicultural ministry in the New Lutheran Church, a new commission on multicultural ministry. The debate in that formative process was a very interesting one and seems to me globally significant. The debate, part of the debate was this: how do we understand the relationship of whites to people of color? And here again, I was going to use a blackboard, but I have to envision this. One side of the argument was this: that desk in a predominantly white church, read predominantly white society if you want to do it in secular terms, that desk ought to be the place where people of color, blacks, Latinos, Asians, Native Americans, can control a piece of the turf, get their own act together, and interact, a power base from which to interact with the rest of the church. Okay, that was one side of the argument. The other side of the argument said, no, that's an incredibly paternalistic way of looking at that desk. What that desk ought to look like is there ought to be a desk for blacks, yes, for Hispanics, yes, for Native Americans, yes, for Asians, yes, and for whites, yes, right alongside the other four, all right? Rather than saying within a white institution, you've got four desks for people of color, rather treat the department as an institution where all five groupings, treating whites as just one of five groupings, can get around a table and deal. So it's a smaller pond, but more equality, rather than the bigger pond and less equality. Right, you understand the kind of debate? And I think that that's in a country where we can still, although there are lots of reasons not to, but where we still basically call people of color minorities, right? Because they are. When the whites are in the majority, that debate will always happen. And it's not clear always where the people of color involved in the debate will come down on the debate. Because successful multicultural processes always depend on dealing with the question of power first. well, that's the challenge, you know. We're now a nation that's 23 or 24% people of color. By the year 2010, we'll be a nation that's about 35% people of color. The black population in relation to the rest will grow slightly. The Hispanic populations will take off geometrically. Increasing probably, depending on the immigration rulings in the next couple of decades, increasing numbers of people from other parts of the world, particularly Asia also, will be coming. So the numbers are there for us to be increasingly representative of the globe. The question is the will there on our parts to be reflective of something that's exportable to the rest of the globe? I'm not sure the will is there quite yet, but it does seem to me that the prospects of building something that is lasting, multicultural, even with all the problems in our way, is a seductive enough vision that some people anyway, and particularly already in cities, but some people all over the United States can be brought along on that kind of a project. It just seems to me that it's a terrific challenge and an aspiration to celebrate as we move into the 4th of July. I'd like to hear from people about some of your multicultural experiences, and particularly in relationship to power. I've been arguing that successful multicultural work always depends on some dealing with the question of power. And that means that it's going to be different if whites have the power interacting with blacks, there's more or less equal power, or if in fact some of you have some experience where, as white people, you were in situations where blacks really held the cards. Those would obviously be sort of micro situations, since there are no macro situations where the blacks do hold the cards. But in fact, some of the individual experiences that we have are in those sorts of settings, whether it's in, wherever it might be. And I want you to, so one leading question is, do you have some stuff out of your own experience that points to the way in which the power between the groups, between you and who you were interacting with, affected the way in which the interaction went, how it happened?
You know, the concern you raise about a multicultural society will work when we share the power. Well, in order to share the power, you have to have a literate nation to do that. And I think the literacy issue is probably more important than sharing the power right now. Because you can share the power, and if the group that you give it to is illiterate or cannot understand the functions of democracy, they will lose the power and then forever be forgotten or, you know, subjected to a second-class status. So I think before the grand multicultural part that we can offer the rest of the world will come about will be when we become a literate nation of everyone. Because then the people will be able to share the power and be effective with it. You can give the power up because, you know, the power giver knows that if you have a literate section that you give it to, you're going to get that just by default. So I think the added dimension of illiteracy has to be addressed, or the grand, you know, experiment is not going to come to fruition as soon as we'd like to see it.
Mm-hmm. you're talking really about how it is, what it is people need to bring with them to get to the table.
And I think the power givers are going to have to go out there and make sure we have a literate and educated nation, because that's what makes democracy run.
We're certainly heading the wrong direction, basically, in that endeavor at this point. Yeah.
Just for my own edification, what do you mean by power? Because I was hearing it in relationship to your first presentation, and I heard that the hopelessness was basically economic in nature. And I'm not making the bridge. Is power, in your context, economic, social?
Well, you know, Saul Alinsky used to say that there's two forms of power. You know, there's money and there's people.
That's...
And if you don't have money, then you've got people and you're into the political process and the process of social interaction. And I think that for most people of color in the United States, they are locked out of the current economic power structures, and they are not quite as locked out of the current people power structures. So I'm interested, insofar as it's possible to pursue a vision of multicultural interaction, I think that the arena to pursue that in at this point, given reality, is in probably in the political social cultural arena. Not, I don't see much at this point in the way of hope for these kinds of principles applied in the purely economic realm. And I think that's a problem. I mean, you're pointing to a real problem.
I can share my experience. I have a couple of experiences I'd like to share that sort of illustrate, I think, what you're talking about. One is my workplace, and the other is our Metro Chicago Synod.
Mm-hmm. You speak up a little.
Okay. I work for AT&T Bell Laboratories, and I've worked for them for not quite 20 years. And when I first went to work for Bell Laboratories, it was, I would guess, about 95% white. The other 5% were most likely Asian, because it is approximately between a half and two-thirds PhDs that work there. But being a company that had government contracts, they had to, when affirmative action came in, abide by the government's direction on affirmative action. I think, to its credit, Bell Laboratories is sort of a beacon within the rest of AT&T. They took it seriously. And so if you walk into a meeting at Bell Laboratories now, it is very likely that no matter what size meeting, from five up, there will be a person of color, there will be women, and there always have been Asians present, but even more now. People, perhaps in the beginning, worried and talked, just like I've heard mentioned here, that, well, if you look for black candidates, the schools they go to aren't as powerful as schools as the current population. And there was worry about that. And there was care, and it was paid attention to, but there has not been any diminution in the quality of work that goes on at Bell Laboratories as a result of affirmative action. And it is a neater place to work now. And so what a lot of people found onerous and distasteful has turned out to be a good thing.
So
let me proceed. The ELCA formation, we were here a few years ago when Will Hertzfeld sat in this room and told us about what was going to happen. And the first vision we heard was a new church, not a merger. Well, that's too much to ask for. It has to be a merger. But the other thing he spoke out about as a vision was that it was going to be inclusive, and inclusive by design. And no matter how you name it, it still means that means you're going to say at the outset that we're going to use quotas to ensure seats and inclusiveness. And there are problems with that, and there are things, it is hard to find enough candidates. That means you have to work harder. Mm-hmm. You really have to work harder. But when we went to the Constituting Convention for the Metro Chicago Synod, it is a multicolor, multicultural event now. And it is a neat place. There are exciting things that are going to happen in that place because of that. And so I think, though, even though those can't be held up as examples for government to follow, because power there is controlled by fewer people. You can, by direction, say how things are going to go. I think that has been a very positive experience for me and for the people who took part in those things. Mm-hmm. Both of those situations, I think, probably were different than government, in that they both have some higher goal that is of a common interest that's very clear. A company, in that it has to remain viable as an economic entity and keep going, or none of us that work there will work there. And the church has, even though there's politics and things that are like street work there too, it is an institution that has a higher purpose, and so it is different than playing for economic power in the streets of Chicago. Mm-hmm. And so I think it is easier in some sense, because it is less democratic, to make it work in industry and in a church that is not really a voting democracy, mm-hmm. than it is in the public domain. But perhaps the thing that could make this model work more is if somehow those who are trying to lead this way can find things that can be raised as a higher good rather than playing with the chips on the table.
Sure. Democracy here is being described as a process, not as a goal. There certainly are goals that one builds into governing. Thank you for those hopeful reports. That's good to hear.
Well, I keep being part of the answer. That can be legislated to some extent, but as you say, depending on the situation, it varies. But you don't wait until, so to speak, and the majority says, well, wait, they're not ready yet.
Yeah.
that's a false approach. You can legislate it, as you say, if you work hard at it. And there are people out there who are ready, who are prepared, who are trained, who have the ability, if they're given the chance.
See, the thing that happened in industry in the United States was, I forget what year the Equal Opportunity Law was enacted, but for about a generation, I think for nearly 20 years, we operated under that, and the statistics of who was in industry did not change, even though we claimed to be equal opportunity employers. It was only after we were forced to adopt goals and say we're going to change things that things changed. While we were waiting and hiring the most qualified, and that's where most things get, where things usually get hung up. These are the qualifications, and anyone above that is eligible for a position, you're okay. But if you say, I only want the most qualified, then there are usually so many intangibles that that the color doesn't change or the culture doesn't change. It's
a chicken and egg. The whole affirmative action question is often a chicken and egg kind of question. It was certainly true in Chicago when we elected a black mayor that there was not the talent in the black community or the experience in the black community to run a government. I mean, you think about it, that's perfectly logical. They've never had a government to run in Chicago, right? No, obviously there's no experience, right? Everybody in City Hall in Chicago, like in a lot of other older cities, was Irish for a long time. And So the first thing we did was to go to Atlanta, which had had a black mayor for the last decade and had begun to train blacks who knew how to do city government, right? Now, with 4 or 5 years of a black mayor under our belt in Chicago, there's a lot of talent that has, in fact, responded to the opportunity and now knows what to do in a city hall. So, you know, but yet the argument is often used, you know, there are no qualified folks out there. Well, of course there aren't any qualified folks out there and any opportunities to get qualified.
When you said we, who are you referring to?
One of my hats is as an advisor to the mayor of Washington, of Chicago. I was chair of his policy committee for the last campaign, and I continue to do some work in his cabinet. Sorry, I said that the first time.
Have you talked to David Brown since he found out who's been elected to what?
Yeah, he's real disappointed, and I am too. You know, we're going to end up all these wonderful visions for the new Lutheran Church. We're going to end up with no people of color among the 65 bishops, except for the bishop from Puerto Rico.
Well, he said most of the people are white males over 50 who have been elected.
That's right, and all of the head, that's right, all of the executive directors, the heads of the new commissions will be white male over 50 bureaucrats, except for a woman who will head the Women's Commission, right? And probably a black, although he or she hasn't been selected yet, that'll head the Multicultural Commission. I mean, it really
is a sad state of affairs.
Looks like 1955 to me.
Yeah. If the church realized that we're, you know, the community of God's people.
The thing about moving toward multicultural processes and realities is that all of the natural momentum, doing business as usual, will end up like it's ending up in the ELCA right now. Business as usual will always exclude people of color in the United States.
I don't find that discouraging. I think just like at Bell Laboratories 20 years ago, you walk in the room and it's all white. You walk in, now it's not. You walk in, we do not yet have a black president of AT&T or AT&T Bell Laboratories, but we have the next to the highest level now, and we wouldn't have had not things changed. I think it will change.
Things do take time. You're absolutely right.
The Senate convention at Chicago, the final three were John Tejan, Sherman Hicks, and Phyllis Anderson, a white male over 50, a female, and a black. The black candidate, Sherman Hicks, is very qualified, and there were black candidates in the, black representatives in the room, but it turns out that as the voting proceeded, John Tejan emerged as winner. But I saw that as a hopeful election, not one to be discouraged in this regard. Sherman Hicks will be a bishop soon. Mm-hmm.
I just came from the Women's Constituting Convention of the ELCA.
In Milwaukee.
And I found it exciting because I didn't like the concept of quotas, but I can see the necessity of that to begin. And women of color were very much in evidence and are very much in evidence on the board.
That's exciting.
It's very exciting. And they were sharp women. So, maybe the women will move the church.
Go get it.
On the other hand, in the, whatever it's called, Synod B in California, previously in the South Pacific District of the ALC, we had a black bishop. He was one of the three final contestants. He was not elected. But in that case, I would have to say that the person elected was a good choice. And, I mean, you know, color isn't the only criteria.
Absolutely.
Well, and the truth is, it really does take time. I mean, if you think back, how many years have the women, for example, been able to be ordained?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so you can't expect, I mean, that's going to take time to build up, so that they become more known and more of them. You know, one of the, at our convention last summer, the national convention, one of the ladies got up and clergy wanted the quotas to be, as far as clergy is concerned, half female and half men clergy. Well, that, I mean, that isn't even realistic. I mean, when you think of the percentage of women to men that you are then going to expect, I mean, you'd have to use almost all the women clergy there were to fill these positions. You know, so obviously that got defeated. But, you know, I mean, we just need to use it as stepping stones, and I have no question. I believe it's going to be there. Mm-hmm. And it was, again, extremely exciting to have Black Lutheran pastors, which is a new experience for me in the Midwest, get up and have their presentations and be the leader for all the sessions. You know, it was really exciting. They added new flavor and excitement to worship.
Terrific.
It was. But I believe it'll come, but it takes time. It really takes time. Mm-hmm. I think we've come a long way.
But the issue that's going to make it go in the ELCA is strictly the budget. If they give that chair money, you know, budgeted amounts of money that will train the people and get the people out, it will work. But if they treat it as a low budgetary priority, it will fail.
It's a good hard-headed point.
We look, you know, let's face it, your budget is your priority goal setting tool. If you say the church is important and that we have missions important, but we turn around and find out that all we're spending our money is to build buildings, and it's obvious buildings is our goal. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what's going to make this chair go, is when people keep looking at those budgets, say, hey, let's put more money into that item, because it won't go if they treat it as a low budget item. Mm-hmm. Then that person can work their heads off, and they're going to go home.
That's right. Sure sign of seriousness. Size of the dollars. How about, are there experiences here of your entering into another culture as a minority? I mean, for me, it was incredibly formative at age 19 or 20, whatever I was, to spend the summer in Mississippi in the voter registration drive and live in a Black community with an entirely Black culture around. I have never thought the same way since about faith or religion or family or money or anything else around, and I don't think there's anything like that kind of cross-cultural immersion for anybody to go through, and I suspect lots of you have had experiences like that in your lives, and certainly part of what a church ought to be is enabling that kind of thing to go on more and more. A lot of what we're talking about is, you know, bringing elements anyway of all of other cultures into what is still, after all, a white defined reality. If we're talking about the ELCA, I think real multicultural interaction has to be two ways in lots of ways, and you know, maybe we ought to require all of the white officials of the ELCA to spend 6 months dealing with a Black Baptist congregation, or you know, in some kind of experience that gives them a look at a church from a different perspective, and from the perspective that a Black entering Lutheranism has.
Jody, I'd like to go back to your earlier point. I think it's very good on the, you know, the multiracial sense of the United States being absolutely unique, and it is, and if it can be a beacon to the rest of the world, that would be a tremendous legacy. My feeling is, though, as bad as we are in the States, and where I travel internationally, things are much more polarized ethnically and religiously overseas than they are in the States. And so the hope, while it's a great hope, I don't see, let's say, the Japanese and the Koreans getting on for a long time. And so, again, we had a lot of positive things, but on the global sense, I'm throwing out some pessimistic thing on that too.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I deal a lot with the Japanese community in Chicago because my brother works in that community a lot. And they are continually astounded and relearning their own racial thinking from their experience in Chicago. I mean, it's not that they're unmoved, untouched, unaffected by what happens to them in the United States. Their prime minister was what did he say about 6 months ago, that one of the reasons that the Japanese are beating the stuffings out of the United States in terms of international business is because the United States has these silly minorities sort of dragging them down. I mean, that's essentially what he said,
exactly,
right?
What he said.
But he was jumped on by that. That brought Jesse Jackson over to see him. And in fact, the local Japanese community in my city, and I think in other cities as well, was also jumped on by a lot of the press and a lot of the black leadership in particular, and some whites, church leadership too. I think a good illustration of what I'm talking about, ways in which some kind of at least acknowledgement that we're dealing with multicultural reality brought up short.
Yeah.
That's
something that you know can be done or is being done here well, but Korean in Japan
absolutely
is absolutely a second class
citizen. Yeah.
I think what you were just saying about the Japanese community, I think it raises a good point, because I think we have to be careful not to treat all minority groups as a whole sort of group together, in terms of, especially in terms of power issues. I mean, I think as far as we need to go with the black power, I mean, black community and the shared power with that, I mean, I think the Latino community is still sort of the forgotten group in many places, and feel sort of left out of shared leadership from all various ethnic groups. I just returned I spent last week with the General Synod of the United Church of Christ, which is my church affiliation, and I think the UCC, I think I can safely say, has really been, probably of the mainline denominations, the church that has pushed quotas longer than anyone else, and it shows in the leadership of the church. But it's still, the black leadership there is much more prominent than the Latino leadership.
Yeah.
And that became a crucial issue at this synod. The Latinos walked out of the synod because they felt like they were really not being heard.
Unfortunately,
there was some real reconciliation around that.
Within the church, does the issue of language become a problem there too, as it will or does in the
political arena? Sure. I mean, I think that complicates it further.
Yeah,
but
the multi-language
community is a step behind, I think, in terms of having the experience at governmental levels in terms of being involved in governmental structures and their own sense.
And of course, it's obviously it's diverse within itself too.
Oh yeah,
there are Latino communities. We have to end. It's 7 o'clock. I really just meant to lay out an agenda for all of us to work on for the next 20 years.